You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Why aren't they asking the right question? This just totally baffles. Well, it doesn't totally baffle me. It totally infuriates me. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and the question that is being asked over on Politico, on the Washington Post, on the TV shows, everybody's asked the question, will Newt continue after he gets his butt handed to him in Florida today? Is he going to, does he have the intestinal fortitude to carry on? Does he have the emotional resilience? Is he going to go all the way? Nobody is pointing out the fact that, first of all, he's having his ass handed to him because Mitt Romney ran something like 12 or 13,000 television ads, and Newt was only able to run a few hundred. And it wasn't Mitt, by the way, who ran them. It was the super PAC controlled by a bunch of his old vulture capital fund buddies. And Newt didn't run his ads. That was a super PAC controlled by Shelley Adelson, or funded by. So here you've got a situation, you know, all the largest single recipient now of Wall Street money, Mitt Romney. Millions of dollars in Wall Street money going to Mitt Romney. But it's not actually going to Mitt Romney. It's going to PACs that are running ads on behalf of Mitt Romney. And Shelley Adelson, who is this seventh, eighth richest guy in the country or the world or something like, very, very wealthy guy, makes a lot of his money out of casinos like in Macau, this little island off the coast of Taiwan, off the coast of China, and in the United States. And this guy's like a fervent, fervent pro-Israel, only his notion of being pro-Israel means you start bombing Arab countries. Right, he wants to start a war with Iran, and Newt's his guy. Newt's willing to do that, or at least says he is, or words to that effect. And so Shelley Adelson comes up with $5 million, and Newt uses that to kick Romney's butt in South Carolina. And Romney says, "Okay, I've learned from this." But actually, the people who learned from it were the hedge fund managers and the billionaires and the Wall Street guys and the brokers and the private equity, also known as leveraged buyout hustlers on Wall Street, who are Mitt's buddies, who are pouring millions of dollars into the Florida campaign. I mean, Mitt's outspending Newt 6-1. And the question that nobody's asking, and this is what blows my mind, just notice the news coverage. The question nobody's asking is Shelley Adelson going to write another $10 or $20 million check for Newt? Because the only reason that Newt's even in Florida right now, the only reason that he can afford an airfare down there is because Shelley Adelson has been writing these checks. And for that matter, you know, will the hedge fund guys continue backing Romney? Well, on that, there can be no doubt. He's one of them. He has fought raising the 15% top tax rate for millionaires and billionaires who make their income with carried interest and long-term capital gains. For years, for decades, he's fought that, making sure that it stays that low, 15%. That you and me and other people who work for a living, we can pay as much as 35% in income taxes and federal income taxes, but no way that a private equity guy, private equity is how they've rebranded what used to be called leverage buyout guys, the LBO companies. They renamed them after they got a bad reputation in the 80s. They're now called private equity guys. That's what Romney is. There's no way that these private equity guys are going to back off. They got billions. They're going to take Romney all the way to the end. So the question is Shelley Adelson going to back off? We no longer have candidates fighting each other or competing with each other. We no longer have ideas competing with each other. What we have are dueling billionaires. Shelley Adelson is a billionaire. He's supporting Newt. And you got a bunch of Wall Street millionaires and billionaires supporting Mitt. The Wall Street millionaires have been able to outspend Newt's billionaire by about 6-1, and so Mitt Romney is probably going to carry Florida, you know, by 10 or 20 points tonight. But nobody's pointing this out, particularly in the corporate media, particularly the corporate television media, because where do all those ads run? Where do all those dollars go? Where do those 13,000 television ads run? On the corporate television media. So you're not going to hear many complaints about that. And, of course, right-wing talk radio isn't going to talk about it until Obama gets in the race. And Paul Begala, who's put together a PAC to support Obama, starts spending money. And then it's going to be, oh, my God, look at that. George Soros supposed to donate $1 million to the PAC. But this is, I mean, spending on political ads in the Republican primary, comparing now to the last Republican primary 4 years ago, up 1,600%. 1,600%, 16 times higher. And that was a fairly contested Republican primary last time around. Yeah, last time around, as I recall, John McCain and Mitt Romney were slugging it out, and Mitt Romney spent something like $40 million of his own money. That was back before Citizens United, so that was the only way you could do it. A rich guy could fund his own campaign. If you weren't rich, you had to rely on $2,500 donations, so you'd get these bundlers. That's what George W. Bush did. You get a guy and you say, hey, you want to be the ambassador to England? All you have to do is find, you know, find 1,000 rich guys who will put in $2,500 each and, you know, bundle all those checks together and hand me that $2.5 million worth of checks in an envelope with your name on it, and you've got the ambassadorship. And that's how it used to work. Now they don't even do that dance. And we call this a democracy? I mean, you could call it a kleptocracy, you know, government by theft, except that, you know, it's really government facilitating that. You could call it a plutocracy. We have the plutocrats running things. It's the millionaires versus the millionaires. Newt's worth 30, $40 million. Mitt Romney's worth a couple $100 million. I mean, even Barack Obama now is worth millions of dollars, although, you know, he at least earned his money the old-fashioned way. He wrote some books, and they're generating revenue. But I just find this amazing, and what I find most amazing about it is that the media is, if they want to play it as a horse race, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, you know, everybody gets it. There's a sports aspect to politics. But at least play it honestly as a horse race. Who's going to come up with more money? Hedge fund manager John Paulson or casino mogul Shelley Adelson? Is it going to be the hedge fund candidate, Mitt Romney? Or is it going to be the bomb Iran candidate, Newt Gingrich? Which one is it going to be? Whose special interest is going to win in this primary? So far, it looks like it's going to be the banksters. In fact, I can guarantee all the way to the end it's going to be the banksters. We always knew the banksters had the most money. After all, we gave them $9, $10, $12 trillion.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And now they're recycling that money. As Newt Gingrich pointed out, Goldman Sachs recycling our tax dollars through the Mitt Romney campaign. Is that right? Okay, so clip number 9, Jacob. Here's Newt coming out and saying, announcing a newly released poll. Now, tragically, the poll was information that was several days old, but Newt didn't quite tell that to the audience yesterday. Here he is.
Polls are all over the place. We just got word of a brand new poll that came out about an hour ago that says we are now tied 35-35.
Yeah, good luck, Charlie, when you got the Wall Street billionaires outspending you by a fortune. But nonetheless, clip number eight, when Newt is using that language, right?
We are going to go all the way to the convention, and we are going to win in Tampa.
Yeah. I mean, the convention's going to be in Tampa. So he's talking about he's going to be the next nominee for President of the United States. I don't think Shelley Adelson has that much money. And I don't think Newt has any other billionaires who are going to help him out. Because by and large, the billionaire class in America is with the guy who's actually damn close to being a billionaire, Mitt Romney. And Newt Gingrich is kind of a pesky problem for them, although he's always, you know, worked for their advantage and on their side. But, you know, there's only a small portion of the billionaire class that really wants there to be more wars. The rest of them would be quite happy if America was a little more prosperous so they could skim a little more off the top here. There's a small portion of the billionaire class who make money on wars, but the rest of them pretty much don't. They make their money on banking and manufacturing and making computer stuff and things like that. And so they're not, you know, they're just not Gingrich guys and gals. Maybe a few. This is mostly a male thing. But it's just, this is, well, in addition to this, now this is Gingrich's latest thing. He will basically, he's basically saying he's only going to do future debates if they're moderated by Sean Hannity, right? You know, by somebody who is clearly on his side. He didn't say Sean Hannity by name, but, you know, or Limbaugh, but, you know, but you get the point. Because why should Republicans have to respond to actual questions from actual reporters who might even ask actual follow-ups when Roger Ailes set this up way back during the Nixon administration? You have these phony debates. Nixon did this tour that Roger Ailes put together. We traveled around the country. They would handpick six people in each place where he went, who were their people who would ask softball questions. They packed the audience full of Republicans so that you had, Roger Ailes referred to it as the applause machine, and it made Richard Nixon look good, and they kept the press out. In fact, the press had to watch the event in another room on television. So all the questions being put to Nixon, and this is how, in part how Nixon won the election in 68, all the questions being put to Nixon, or maybe this was 72, one or the other, but in one of those two elections, the way that they put the questions to him was, you know, they were handpicked people. This is what Newt wants to go back to. Clip number one, Jacob.
As your nominee, I will not accept debates in the fall in which the reporters are the moderators, because you don't need to have a second Obama person in the debate.
So who could we have moderate these? Well, how about Sarah Palin or Sean Hannity? Here they are talking.
You would vote for Newt. Am I interpreting that right or not?
Yeah, I'd keep the process going. That doesn't mean that I'm out there only boosting one candidate. I'm going to continue to say good things about every GOP candidate.
Yeah, because I'd like to keep my job at Fox News, also known as GOP TV. Alan West, maybe he'd make a good moderator. In fact, he'd make a great moderator for the debates. The wackadoodle congressman from Florida, here he is.
This is a battlefield that we must stand upon. And we need to let President Obama, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, and my dear friend, the chairman of the Democrat National Committee, take your message of economic dependency, take your message of enslaving the entrepreneurial will and spirit of the American people somewhere else. You can take it to Europe, you can take it to the bottom of the sea, you can take it to the North Pole, but get the hell out of the United States of America. Yeah, I said hell.
Yeah, you liberals. How patriotic is that, right? Yes, this is a nation of diversity, of ideas, of debate, of... No, it's not. Get the hell out. amazing. Alan West never ceases to amaze. Oh, and the latest competition, I think Mitt Romney is going to probably back out of this one really fast. First, it was started by President Obama. And, you know, singing the Al Green song. Here's President Obama.
Reverend Al Green was here. So in love with you.
So that, you know, that was President Obama. And so then Mitt Romney says, okay, I got to try this out. And didn't work out quite as well as expected. This isn't American Idol. I'm not the perfect judge. Maybe you'll have a different opinion. Here's Mitt.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains' majesty above the fruited plain.
Now, I'm not saying I could do any better, but, you know, I certainly couldn't beat President Obama's falsetto. So, anyway, back to the serious stuff. And the really serious stuff is that right now what we're seeing in the Republican primary, tragically, as we watch our democracy slowly disintegrate as a consequence of it and be replaced by a plutocracy, by a corporate aristocracy. You know, the average wealth of the Tea Party Republicans in the House of Representatives, these 100 new guys who came in, is more than double, almost triple that of the average wealth of the average member of the House of Representatives. We're seeing more and more rich people being paid for by more and more rich people coming into politics because of the Supreme Court and because of Citizens United. And it's now not a debate between Mitt and Newt. It's a debate between Mitt's funders and Newt's funders about who's going to spend the most money.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we have to do something about that, and soon. Move to amend.org. Well, Joe is long gone, but if he were a super PAC, he would live on. I mean, this is the amazing thing. Once you have the corporate form, be it for-profit or not-for-profit, once you have the corporate form, it can live forever. Used to be corporations lived 20, 30, maximum 40 years in the United States until the 1890s. And then things changed. The robber barons got control of things, and they sure did change things. It's just amazing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the airwaves. And Grover Norquist, by the way, has, as I pointed out yesterday, compared President Obama letting the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of this year, as they are scheduled to expire, with treason, high crimes and misdemeanors, in other words, an impeachable offense. Meanwhile, a new CBS New York Times poll says that most Americans want to get rid of the capitalist gains tax and just say, hey, people like Mitt Romney, people like Warren Buffett, they should be taxed at the same rate their secretaries are. What's so special about these guys? You know, they walk around in shoes that are filled with goose down or something. So what? Does that mean they should pay lower taxes? I always thought it was amazing. You know, it's like those who have get more. It's like when on the airline frequent flyer programs, and you know, some of them advertise this, some of them just tell their most frequent flyers. But on the airline frequent flyer programs, when you hit the top level, you don't just get miles. You get miles plus you get bonus miles. So you rack up miles faster than the average person racks up miles because you're a frequent flyer. You're one of their, you know, you're one of the customers that they really want to keep. And the right wing spin on this whole thing just hit me. So what they're going to say is, yeah, and these rich people, these are the people we really want to keep in America. We don't want them to flee to the Caymans or something. And so we've got to keep low taxes on them. If they have a lot, we give them big tax breaks. People who don't have a lot, screw them. Charge them higher taxes. And that's what's going on. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it. That's what's going on. So Marty thinks he has a solution. Hey, Marty, thanks for listening to K-Talk in Los Angeles. What's up?
Tom, I think we have to approach this from a different angle. As much as we don't like Citizens United, as long as it's the law of the land, we have to beat them at their own game. And I refer back to like what the Republicans did to John Kerry. They went after him of what they thought was a very strong position, his military background. If we can get our billionaires, at least this cycle, to put in their Sheldon Adelson-type contributions to where the Republicans don't think they have an advantage, Move to Amend will have a much better chance of passing when they don't think they're dominating anymore.
Well, that would make a lot of sense, but, you know, everybody likes to make George Soros the boogeyman. He is a billionaire. But the fact of the matter is that his political contributions aren't squat compared to, a whole, you know, the Koch brothers. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, we've got a few billionaires on our side who are good people who help out here and there.
Yeah.
But and God bless them. They're people like Bill Gates, who's actually giving money to like eradicate polio. I mean, they're doing well-intentioned things. There are some wealthy people who are not psychos, right? But that said, the reality of the situation right now is that when the billionaires backing Romney spend money on his campaign, and he will be the Republican nominee, so he's going to be the guy that is going up against Obama. So when those billionaires back Romney, the money that they put, it's exactly like lobbying right now. If you're a company and you want to get a $100 million contract to sell Chertoff X-ray porno scanners, you go to Michael Chertoff, you give him a couple million bucks, you spend a few million bucks on congressional campaigns and lobbying and whatnot, and for that few million dollar investment, you make hundreds of millions of dollars back. It's pure business deal. And the billionaires on the right, they get it, that if they put money into the Romney campaign, they're going to get far more than whatever they put in as contributions. They're going to get far more than that back out when Romney becomes president, and he appoints a couple more right wingers to the Supreme Court, and they not only affirm Citizens United, but even strengthen it and give more and more power to corporations and rich people. And there's the billionaires on the left, it's like if you're a billionaire, do you really want to give money to somebody who's going to raise your taxes, which is what Obama has said he's going to do? I mean, there's a few of good conscience, but it's nothing like the number of billionaires who are supporting Mitt Romney and will support him.
We have to tap them, though, and they're out there, you know, and I can name about 10 just off the top of my head. But what do you also think about Warren Buffett and Bill Gates actually doing a commercial with a voiceover starting at the beginning that says something like, the two most successful businessmen in the world, we endorse Barack Obama, we don't want anything from him. We think he's good for business.
Well, here's the problem. Neither one of them have endorsed Barack Obama. Neither one of them have ever, you know, come out and endorsed a candidate. And I doubt either one of them will, A. And B, they don't want to be seen as getting into the campaign. Gates at Davos made the comment, yeah, I think that it's not unreasonable, words to the effect of, I don't think it's unreasonable that I pay, you know, the same income tax rate as my secretary. That's just fair, you know, the Buffett rule. And Warren Buffett, of course, is behind that. But that's a single issue. And that's a single issue that's actually going to cost them more money.
But, you know, I'm not for unilateral surrender. I don't want to get up here and say, well, gee, they're the bad guys. They're spending all the money while we lose more congressional seats. We'll never get moved to amend pass. We have to beat them at their own game to where they say, okay, money is crazy in this election cycle. We're going to get rid of it. We're with you. And the only way we can do that is by electing more of our people. And
sure,
we're not going to do it if we let them outspend us.
And well, yes and no. Generally speaking, people who spend the most win the elections. But in California, for example, and you're in California, remember what happened to Meg Whitman? I mean, she outspent Jerry Brown, what, 5-1, 10-1, 15-1, some mind-boggling amount. She spent,
but remember what happened to your friend, Mr. DeFazio, in Oregon.
Yeah.
You know, when all that money came in on him.
But he won.
We have to do that to them.
Peter won. It was a squeaker, but it won. And so my point is that possibly, you know, yes, of course, Obama's going to go to as many wealthy people as he can and get as much money as he can. And a lot of that's probably going to come out of Hollywood. And you know, so be it. But the fact of the matter is that it's never going to be a business investment. If good progressives, you know, like Barbara Streisand and those kinds of folks are giving money to the Obama campaign, that's not a business investment. That's an investment in the future of America, in their vision of America, in our collective vision of America, as opposed to, you know, them trying to get richer. Whereas the guys on Wall Street are investing in Mitt Romney because he's rich and he's going to make them richer. And that's his promise. And he's said it over and over again. I think the way to beat them is to expose them. I think that's what happened when, that's why Carly Fiorina went down in flames in California, and that's why Meg Whitman went down in flames in California, even though both of them thought they could buy their elections, was because they were exposed as people who were trying to buy elections. And, Marty, thanks for the call. That has to be the essence of the message, and we have to get the message out. And the problem is that the media is absolutely resistant to communicating that message, which was where I started this whole rant at the beginning of this hour with, is why is the media not talking? Why are they saying, hey, does Newt have the strength to go to the end? Rather than saying, hey, does Shelley Adelson have the strength to go to the end with Newt, funding Newt, or funding the PAC that's supporting Newt? Does he? Is he? We don't know. That's the big question. Ruth in Rochester, New York. Hey, Ruth, what's up?
On this business of the side that spends the most money, you've just said that they win the primary
about 90% of the time.
The election.
Yeah, about 90% of the time.
What does that say about the electorate? I mean, they still, it's one man, one vote, right? In the booth. I mean, are we?
What
are
that
we
says done? Is that advertising works. It doesn't say that the American people are stupid. The fact of the matter is, for most Americans, politics is something that they pay attention to every 4 years in a big way, every 2 years in a small way, and they only pay attention to it in a small window of a few weeks, at the most a month or so. And that's when most of the political money is spent. It's just running up to the election. It's going to get crazy in October.
Yeah.
And right now, you've got people who are genuinely concerned about political issues and democracy in America. But the people, you know, most people, you know, they've got two, three kids. They're working their butts off. They're working two and three jobs. You know, they when they get home, the last thing they want to do is get all worked up about politics. You know, they want something to take their mind away from it, so they turn on, you know, The Mentalist or CSI or something like that and veg out. And you know, with, you know, recreational television, or they listen to music, or they go to a basketball game or something. You know, they're and who can blame them? I mean, you know, these are bizarre times. They don't understand. They weren't taught, you know, we don't teach civics anymore. They didn't get it. That politics is going to define the future of this country and the future, frankly, of the quality of their lives. And then in the meantime, you've got this giant propaganda machine over at Fox News saying, don't worry, everything's going to be happy. Just leave it to the billionaires and the millionaires. You've got all these giant think tanks saying the same thing, pushing their message through corporate media, through right-wing media. You've got the Wall Street Journal now taken over by Rupert Murdoch and his right-wing minions. Increasingly, it's easy enough to find the message that tells you, don't worry, be happy, just chill out. We got this under control, you know?
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I don't think it's that Americans are dumb, Ruth. The good news is that more and more of them are starting to pay attention. You know, the Tea Party eruption, which was, you know, a phony populist, but it was an attempt. And now the Occupy Wall Street eruption. These are symptoms of a society that is starting to pay attention to politics. I think they're a good sign. Ruth, thank you so much for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, and French President Sarkozy, he's saying to the banksters, time to start paying up, buddies. Cameron in England is frantic. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And apropos of the tease I left you with about Sarkozy, Robert in Clinton, Illinois. Hey, Robert.
Well, I'm in favor of the Clinton Sarkozy type of taxation, but it should be on all stock transactions, both in and out, and on commodity transactions in and out.
Yep. I agree with you.
Tax them both ways.
I agree with you. Sarkozy just wants to put it on stocks, but you're absolutely right. And this is called a securities transaction exchange excise tax, ET tax. Although they refer to it, Sarkozy's calling it the Robin Hood tax. He wants to put a 1/10 of 1% tax on all stock transactions. It'll do away with high frequency trading. It'll dampen speculation. It'll make the markets less volatile. It won't affect, you know, people who are using the market as a place to invest for the long term at all. I mean, you might end up paying $8 a year more on, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in a portfolio, something like that. But it will have a big impact on the people who are churning the market. And you are spot on, Robert. And Sarkozy is going to do this. He's going to push it through in France, or he's certainly going to try. And he's committed to, and he's the conservative candidate, by the way. Sarkozy is the George Bush of France. He's got a socialist breathing down his neck who's probably going to beat him in the next election, who definitely wants to tax the banks. Now, the fact of the matter is, in France, the banks aren't the major industry. In the UK, they are, just like they are in the US. They account for a large part of the GDP of that country, and particularly of the profits of that country and of the people who are funding the political class. And so David Cameron is all over trying to stop this tax. Oh, no, we can't do that. Marie in El Jebel, Colorado. Hey, Marie, what's up?
A couple of comments and then a question. First of all, Mitt Romney pitched America the Beautiful too high. I'm a musician. I know tenors. Mitt Romney is not a tenor.
There you go.
Second thing, if we would take Monty Python's Every Sperm is Sacred and play it as a commercial nonstop around the world, we'd slow down population growth, I promise you.
Okay, I'll have to track it down.
Track it down. It's hysterical. You've got to see it, too. Okay, my question is this, and this goes back to the Citizens United issue. I think it's extremely important for us to know who's funding these campaigns. But there's another side to that as well. They're paying somebody to do the ads. There are agencies that are making millions, if not billions, of dollars off of this. Who are they?
Well, interestingly, one of the big PACs, one of the big super PACs here in Washington, D.C., is controlled by a company that is both a lobbying firm and an ad agency. And so it's an all-in-one shop. So you can give, you know, a couple of million dollars, $10 million to them and say, okay, make it happen. Some of that money they pass off to members of Congress that are on your side. Some of that money they pass off to their own ad agency to produce the ad. And then the ad agency, because they own the ad agency, they can get the 10 or 15% media discount, agency discount when they buy the media buys. And it's become an industry. It's just an industry. Go ahead.
My guess is that it's circular, that it's somehow coming back to the same people.
It is.
And I also think this may have something to do with why the major networks aren't dealing with it.
Oh, of course. Well, they're profiting from it. I mean, they're the
Absolutely.
Ones where that's where the money ends up. That's where the big money is going to end up when the big campaign really starts. Marie, thank you for your call. Very, very well said and well pointed out. And yeah, it is circular. It's billionaires invest in politicians who are going to promote policies which will be to the benefit of billionaires, which is by and large right-wing, you know, there are conservative politicians. And I say conservative, not Republican, because there are conservative Democrats as well as Republicans. AJ, and Wales, Walsenburg, Colorado?
Yes, it's Walsenburg, Colorado. It's about 40 miles north of the New Mexico border.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I would like to tell you that remember the day that Jan Brewer was wagging her finger in President Obama's face?
Right.
That night, Trent Franks, who is the in the House representing Arizona's 2nd District, went on TV to defend her as a compassionate conservative and announced to the country that Arizona now has not a deficit in their budget, but they actually are flush and maybe even ahead. What is important to remember about Jan Brewer is right before the census in 2010, she pulled out of a CCA prison, and let's remember CCA is highly rated on Wall Street.
Right, Corrections Corporations of America. Yeah.
Correct. And we had a prison in Walsenburg. And right before the census, she announced that she was pulling all of her prisoners back to the state of Arizona, locked the gates at the CCA prison, and through Huerfano County, which is the county that Walsenburg is in, and Walsenburg's the county seat, and the city of Walsenburg into absolute spiral. My own property now is worth 45% less than it was the day they announced this. The prison sits empty. CCA, a big corporation funding lots of things, is now in the private prison business. And Jan Brewer got to count them in her census, further showing her assertions regarding people of color and especially Spanish speakers.
Oh, that's very
and
interesting.
It devastated our area.
So she basically...
She then went on to say when we tried to collect the, what was owed from the prison to both the city and the county, sue us. And if you want to get fancy, sue CCA at the same time, which a devastated county certainly cannot do.
Wow. So Jen Brewer's just playing the game and
moving
money around. And whenever any state governor say, oh, and I left, you know, with a balanced budget, the only state in the union that's constitution doesn't require it to have a balanced budget is Vermont. Every other state's constitution requires it. So any politician who's running for office, you know, saying, well, as governor of so-and-so, Massachusetts, fill in the blanks, right? As governor of so-and-so, I had a balanced budget every year. Well, of course you did. Your constitution requires it. You can't have anything else.
The other thing that I would like to have your viewers think about is when we think about the post office, because in this small area down here, our post offices are the there. It's just unimaginable to me that they're going to close some of these. And
yeah.
I would like to encourage everyone, when they get a mailer from someone like Chase Bank or any of these other banks, take that postage paid envelope and stick it right back in the mail. It'll cost them 42 cents every time you do it.
Support your local post office. AJ, thanks a lot for the call. Up next, should Big Brother be watching what you eat?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, so simple question. If we the people can't get together and fight back in a way that is going to keep our children and ourselves, for that matter, healthy against the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in advertising, the companies who want us to buy and eat their products that will make us sick and kill us, if we can't get together and do something about that, say something about that, we getting together, of course, something called government, then who can? Greg Beato is with us with the Reason Institute, Reason Magazine, Reason.com. Hey, Greg, Big Brother is now our diet coach. So what?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show, Tom.
Sure. Thanks for showing up.
It's now our diet coach, so what? That was the question that led me to really start thinking about, you know, how did it get to be our diet coach? Because it didn't seem like that big a deal. What I'm talking about specifically, of course, is this new tool that the federal government has developed called Super Tracker. And what it basically is a calorie counter and weight management piece of software that you can enter in all the food you eat and see how many calories a day you are consuming and also how many calories a day you're burning through exercise and try to manage your weight that way.
Right.
And so, you know, I saw it and I said, oh, that's interesting. They're trying to do that. These things have been around for a while. And then I started... you know, kind of wondering, it's actually kind of weird that the government wants to be, my physical.
Well, you know, I agree with you on that. And here's why. I think that the government, here's the problem. If we the people actually want to help ourselves get healthy, because we all have an interest in this. Right. Every time somebody gets cancer in this country, it costs you and me. It costs all of us. Every time somebody shows up at an ER because they don't have health insurance or because their eating habits are off the scale and they're making themselves sick or because they're smoking and they're making themselves sick, whatever. Every time they show up at an ER, it costs you and me, Greg. So we have an interest in helping Americans to be healthy. And the problem is that the government agencies, that we have asked to help us figure out how to get healthy, you know, put together the food pyramid or whatever, you know, this kind of stuff. Tell us how to eat. You know, you guys do the research. We need somebody to do the research, impartial, somebody who doesn't have an axe to grind, somebody who's not going to make any money off it, to tell us what should be. Those people are, of course, controlled to a certain extent by politicians who are in office, and they are scared to death You had the situation where the food pyramid has been reinvented over and over and over again over the years. You know, dairy goes on, dairy comes off, dairy goes on. It's all the result of changing administrations and changing lobbyists. You've got agencies that should be saying to us, you know, if you eat fast food, everything in moderation. You want to eat a McDonald's? Fine. But if you're going to do it every day because it happens to be the cheapest food in your neighborhood and you're poor, you are going to end up obese. And not just, you know, fill in the blank, not just McDonald's, any of this junk food that's out there.
Right.
Fast food. But the problem is that the federal agencies can't say that. Because if they say that, those corporations will have right-wing politicians go after the government, and will take down the politicians who are basically protecting those agencies. And as a result of that, what we have is nothing but corporate propaganda.
Well,
how do we stop that?
I would put difference. You said a lot there. I would put different, perspective on a lot of what you said. I do agree that one of the really interesting things about the way this policy has evolved is that it grows out of the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, which historically its job was to get people to eat more, you know, to increase agricultural production, which basically means to increase the amount of food people eat.
Well, no, not true. The Department of Agriculture's original job was to make sure that the food supply was safe. And then the promotion part became promoting the interests of farmers. Now that, of course, has become captive to the oligarchy of you know, ADM and whatnot, you know, the giant food companies in Monsanto and whatnot. And again, this is another example of giant corporations capturing government agencies. And I know libertarians and objectivists like yourself think it's wonderful if we have a nation run by giant corporations and the billionaires, who own them. I don't think so, because they're not answerable to me. I want somebody who's answerable to me. If I show up at ADM and start picketing the fronts of their offices, they'll have me arrested. If I go to the CEO and say, I'm going to stand here until he talks to me, they'll have me arrested. On the other hand, I can walk down the street to my congressman's office anytime I want and say, you know, I have a message to, and they're going to have to take my message.
Well, I would again say you're making a lot of assumptions about what different people want. I would argue that, you know, again, the USDA, a huge motivation for it is to get people to eat more food, more agricultural products.
But it shouldn't be. They shouldn't be out there promoting the interests of industry. They should be protecting the consumers. And if they are promoting the interests of industries, if what you're saying is correct, then that agency has lost its moral compass, and they have done so because of the influence of lobbyists and big bucks. And how do we have a government agency that actually works for you and me, for the people, rather than working for industry?
I'm saying part of what the problem is regarding the government's food policy is that it has an agency that is essentially trying to do things that compete with each other. A subgroup of the USDA is the Food and Nutrition Service. And, you know, that's the organization that now basically is trying to get people to eat less through endeavors like Choose My Plate and the food tracker and things like that.
Right.
But it is still part of this bigger group, you know, where the mandate is generally to get people to eat more.
But as I said, that's not how it was set up. That's not how it was envisioned. I mean, are you familiar with Sinclair Lewis's The Jungle?
Sure.
I mean, you know how the USDA came into being.
Upton Sinclair, not Sinclair.
Upton Sinclair, thank you. I always confuse the two of them. That's how it came into being, was, you know, the slaughterhouses and the food processing was so poisonous that not only was it inhumane and awful to the workers, but it was killing people. And that's why they came into being, was to protect us. And over the years, there's been more and more corporate influence creeping into government. How do we create a government that is answerable to you and me rather than the billionaires?
Well, I don't think it is through creating food tracking programs.
I agree. So how do we do it? How do we get the influence of the billionaires out of our government?
Well, it might be, again, what I'm here to talk about, I think, is how did the government get to the point where it is now serving food to three times as many people a day as McDonald's is.
Well, in part, that's because we've pursued Reaganomics for 30 years and we're now in a Great Depression.
Yeah, I would disagree there. I think the food stamp program, which is, you know, gone from a $35 billion program in 2008 to a $70-plus billion program in 2011.
Because of the Bush Great Depression, yeah.
It
of course.
Been, it is, it's been because of specific policies pursued in order to try to influence people's diet.
No, it's because the last 12 months that surrounded the Bush, the departure of George Bush from office, that last 12 months, we were losing between 500 and 800,000 jobs every single month. And every one of those jobs represented, in many cases, an entire family, two, three, four people having to go on food stamps. And when you add that up, you're talking about millions of people.
I think that's part of it. I also think if you actually look at the numbers,
there were more people on food stamps under George Bush than there are on Barack Obama right now.
There were more people?
There were. There were more people on food stamps under George Bush than under Barack Obama right now. The economy's actually gotten better.
No, that's totally incorrect.
Greg, check it out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. Reason.com, by the way, for Greg's writings.
Daytime, I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
Yeah.
Well, at lunchtime, you.
I think you know, we could all sing that song once in a while. I would like an agency of We the People to actually represent We the People, and increasingly right across government. I mean, you know, the FCC working for the broadcasters, the USDA working for the food industry, the FDA working for the drug industry. We have seen, it's called regulatory capture, and we've seen it happen over and over and over again. The first guy to warn about it was Dwight Eisenhower, warning about the regulatory capture of the military, of the Pentagon by the military-industrial complex back in 1961. In January 1961, Dwight Eisenhower made that warning. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I wanted to make the comment that, you know, a lot of these organizations like the Food and Drug Administration, the USDA, in their inception was to serve the population and protect them. And they have lost their moral and ethical mission. And it's been... You know, as soon as they're, you know, as soon as they're founded, almost from the very beginning, the other side tries to undo the regulations. So they put political candidates as head of the agency, and then they are, you know, more favorable to the business that they're going to regulate. There needs to be a total change in how the heads of these different organizations, the Food and Drug Administration, USDA, should have absolutely no connections to the industry that they're regulating. And I also wanted to say that libertarians may be very rational, but the problem is, as you had said, they don't have, well, you didn't say that, but I'm going to say it, is that they have no ethics. They don't see anything as higher or lower. All they see is making money and, you know, whatever they
want. Well,
that's
an ethical frame. You can't say that they have no ethics. They have a different ethos than we do, and theirs is that government should only serve the function of police, basically. Police and military.
Well, I ask this question then. What kind of ethics would a person like Ayn Rand have? You know, in Ayn Rand's world, she was the center of her own universe, and she was an objectivist and also she was also a libertarian. So maybe you could describe that to me. But as I see it, they have no morals and they have no ethics, and it's quite rational to be unethical and be immoral and just, you know, not even address those issues.
Well, it all depends on how you define morality. I think that when we use ad hominems, you know, personal attacks like this person is immoral, that it doesn't advance our cause. I think that instead what we need to do is point out the differences in morality. These people, Ayn Rand, on the one hand, in my opinion, was a genuine sociopath. She saw William Edward Hickman as her role model, a guy who murdered a 12-year-old because he lived outside society, you know, and made him the hero of her novels and things like that. But I don't think that, you know, for example, our guest or the people who are following them or Ron Paul, I don't think that they're sociopaths. I think that they're utopianists. They and so was Ayn Rand to a certain extent. They start every sentence with the phrase, if only everybody would, right? If only everybody would, you know, get rid of government. If only everybody would fall into lockstep behind Monsanto. If only if only there was a free market, a genuinely free market. And they talk about a world that never has been and never will be, and in the process, they're messing up the world that is.
Can I interrupt? I just wanted to say one thing. They equate the free market as, you know, you would equate, say, Mother Teresa feeding the poor. I mean, they don't see any difference qualitatively in certain human actions, and so therefore everything is equal, and that's just fallacious, wrong, and that's what
it is to you and me. But you know, they look at the math that was done by Milton Friedman, who pointed out that in the marketplace, out there in the in the marketplace, there are literally hundreds of millions of decisions being made every second.
Right.
And that the aggregate of those decisions is what moves the marketplace. And how could some bureaucrat sitting in an office in Washington, D.C., looking at a five-year plan, ever be as smart and thoughtful and involved as those 100 million decisions a second? It's not possible. Yeah. And that was Milton Friedman's argument. And that's the argument out of which arises this notion that markets are better than the will of the people, than democracy, than planned, you know, and there is actually some truth to what they're saying. The problem is that those decisions have to be made in a particular context. Just like in a football game or in a baseball game, there's millions of decisions made, and there are hundreds of thousands of decisions, arguably millions, with every individual player, you know, deciding every second where they're going to stand. But they're made within the context of a set of rules, the goal of which is to entertain people. And our economy has to be the decisions in our economy have to be made within a set of rules, the goal of which is not to enrich the few, but rather is to work to the benefit of everybody. And that's where we part company with our conservative fellow human beings.
But I think it's qualitatively better for an economy to serve the real human needs of people. And so I could never come down to that level. And I know I must sound like a pompous ass, but, you know, excuse me.
I don't think so at all. I share your perspective, but you have to understand, these people think that if you let the marketplace work its magic, and Paul Krugman calls it magic fairy dust, market fairy dust, right? If you let the market work its magic, it will work to the advantage of everybody and the world will become a utopia. They really do want the best for everybody, and they think the free market is the way to get there. The problem is, there is no evidence of this in 6,000 years of civilization. No evidence whatsoever. And every time it's been tried, it has failed. And all the other evidence shows that the opposite is true, that regulated markets work rather than unregulated or deregulated markets. The same way, you know, an organized baseball game works, whereas a disorganized baseball game is chaos. And that's, you know, so I don't think it's a matter of moral compass. I think it's a matter of, you know, they don't have, I would say, John, they don't have as complete as an understanding as you and I do. But even that sounds like an ad hominem. But I don't know how else to say it. John, thank you for the call. Thanks for a very thoughtful conversation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We will be back. Who is, you know, should Big Brother be your diet coach? And who is actually running for president? So it looks like Dan Burton from Indiana, the Republican, is going to retire. He's just announced it, even though earlier he had said he's going to run for re-election. You know, K Street, the lobbyist firms, they're out there. They're talking to all the former members of Congress, and they're saying, hey, how'd you like to make $1 million a year? You're only making $160,000 a year as a congressman. I mean, you know, we could do much better than that. We'll see. Steve in Seattle. Hey, Steve.
Huh?
Steve, you're on the air. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I'm a little nervous. It's the first time I've called. But I'm calling. The last caller was talking about how the objectivists have no real ethical base, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And now I read Atlas Shrugged back in ninth grade, and I'm nearly 60. Okay. So it's a little hazy. But essentially what Ayn Rand was a solipsist, okay? And it's a philosophical stance that says that nothing exists but the self. I remember you saying a while ago that Ayn Rand said that when she died, the world went away. That's because for her, the world only existed within herself.
Right. All right. In fact, Jacob's trying to track down that clip right now. We've got it around here someplace.
Okay. So if that's the case, then personal ethics means nothing.
Right, because she was that. Well, in the case of Ayn Rand, here's what she had to say. Listen to this.
I tend to think of this whole thing as ongoing, that there is an eternity.
That's morally safer.
That we are going to be a part of that eternity, that we aren't just corpses and graves when we die.
But we aren't corpses and graves. We are not there. Don't you understand that when this life is finished, you're not there to say, oh, how terrible that I'm a corpse. No.
Well, this is true.
It's finished. And what I've always thought was a sentence from some Greek philosopher. I don't unfortunately remember who it was, that I read at 16, and it's affected me all my life. I will not die. It's the world that will end.
So that's the statement of a sociopath, that the world ends when you die. That
well,
you're the only
really
person who's real in the world.
Sociopathic in a way. I mean, pretty much every serious philosopher agrees that we know nothing but what our senses give us.
Sure.
The solipsists just accept that as a fact and say that the world is only a projection of the internal,
right,
of the internal self. But that was her base. That was the basis of her atheism.
Well, but I'm saying it goes beyond that. That when I say sociopath, I'm talking in a clinical sense. I'm talking about somebody who's incapable of experiencing empathy for others.
Oh,
and,
really?
And that's the cardinal characteristic. A sociopath views every other human as a cardboard cutout character to be moved around for their own gratification. And
well, yeah, truly, truly. But for them,
and I don't think that's solipsism.
It's a projection of themselves. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Every other person exists inside them.
Right.
So they don't really have a connection to them.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the therefore to this, Steve? Or were you just making that point?
I was just actually there isn't really.
Okay.
I was just calling
to point that out.
Kind of expand what I think the other caller was trying to say.
Okay. Well done. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Because we were starting to go down that rabbit hole of philosophy, and I can do that for hours, and makes for lousy talk radio. Nancy, it's like, what? Nancy in Medvin, North Carolina. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to get your opinion on why the U.S. seems so susceptible to propaganda.
I think, well, first of all, by propaganda, are you talking about the advertising of big corporations?
Political,
yeah, political.
Political and even advertising.
Sure. There are a couple of things that are unique about the United States. One of the most significant is how large and geographically isolated we are. The average French person knows very well that there's people next door, you know, in the country right over next door, not only who speaks a different language, who live a different way, but that they've had wars with from time to time. And that, you know, they live on a continent that has had famines and that has had the Black Plague, you know, where massive numbers of people are wiped out. They've had wars with some frequency. We, you know, the last big war on our continent was the Civil War. And before that was the Revolutionary War, and nobody remembers that. Nobody alive remembers that. And so we're largely, and we don't, you know, the countries we border, Canada, we tend to think of as just little America, little United States, and Mexico,
right,
we kind of think of as, oh, that's where the poor people live from the South. And so there's no sense of, gee, maybe somebody else has figured out a way to do things better than us. You know, when the Eastern European countries joined the rest of Europe when the Soviet Union fell, there was a whole lot of looking to Germany, looking to France, looking to Belgium, looking to Holland, looking to other countries and saying, how do they do things that we can learn from? Because they were right next door. And people were, you know, could cross borders and talk to each other. Most only 2% of Americans own passports. So we've got this very kind of xenophobic, insular worldview that allows politicians to say things like, we have the best healthcare system in the world, when it's not true, or we have the cheapest healthcare system in the world, when we actually have the most expensive, or, you know, we have among the healthiest people in the world, when we're actually number 27 in the world, and we have one of the worst obesity rates, or in America, you can become anything you want, whereas, you know, virtually every country in Europe, well, not virtually, every country in Europe, the only country that's less socially mobile than us is Singapore. So every country in Europe is more socially mobile than us. And it's because people are not well informed. They're not informed by virtue of geography, by virtue of, and then by virtue of, because of that, then you get the people who have the power and the money saying, oh, well, you know, let's rewrite the textbooks. Let's the Koch brothers will only contribute to colleges that hire professors that they approve of. And they've got, you know, I think it's over 100 colleges that they're giving money to in economics and other departments. And so I think that these things in aggregate, combined with the fact that since the 50s, the 1950s, the advertising field has become so tightly integrated with the field of psychology, and now with the Frank Luntz type of politics, politics has become so integrated with psychology that they poll test phrases, you know, the Clean Air Initiative, the Clean Skies Initiative, the Clean Water, whatever, you know, those things that George Bush came up with. Bush literally said, you got to understand war is peace, right? And
well,
go ahead.
One of the things that disturbs me so greatly, I've been involved since 1959 in the civil rights movement and other environmental and social justice things all my life. The thing that bothers me now is how susceptible the U.S. population is to, and I'll repeat this supposed quote from Adolf Hitler, make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it.
Yeah, it's actually probably Goebbels who said that, but yes, and here's George Bush.
When we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
There you go. And Nancy, I think that, you know, we will continue to be vulnerable to demagogues and hustlers and marketers until we start waking up, until we take back control of our lives, until the scales fall from our eyes and we start, you know, learning and listening to and seeing the truth. And that's not just our individual work. It's what we've got to do with everybody. We've got to be sharing that message with as many people as possible. Nancy, I want to get some more calls, and thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Let's see. There we go. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Everything you're talking about, I'm kind of leading into the same idea. There are all kinds of rules and regulations about using union dues for political purposes, because heaven forbid my union dues should be used to lobby against what I believe are my best interests or my beliefs.
Right.
Well, why aren't we having the same discussion with the fact that why is it when I go out and buy $10 worth of goods and services, a dollar is being used to lobby against me?
Well, I think some people are waking up to that. You'll remember when Target was outed as being one of the organizations that was funding an anti-gay campaign, and people said that's it for Target, and basically started boycotting the company. I'm pretty sure it was Target, and they came back and said, "Oh no, we're not going to do that anymore." And you know, unfortunately, there were about 10 or 12 other companies that never, you know, really got outed. But I think that, you know, your point is well taken, and in fact, to extend that logic, the people who say, "Oh well, just because 51% of the people in the union voted to use that money to support a particular political candidate or whatever, doesn't mean that the 49%'s rights should be stepped on." You can say the same thing of, well, you know, 51% of Americans voted to have, you know, X as president, or as does that mean that the rest of us should be feel free to ignore the laws that were passed during that time? No. And so, you know, it's a nonsensical argument, although it does sound good to people you know, vulnerable people in, you know, where they're trying to sell right to work for less in various states. So, you know, Bill, you know, thanks for raising the issue. But yeah, I think you could draw parallels to government, which is a democracy. Unions are democratic institutions, and you could draw parallels. And you could say, okay, why did this corporation get to use my dollars to fund, you know, Mitt Romney or Barack Obama for that? And, you know, at the end of the day, my argument is they shouldn't. Either one. Period.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service in just a few minutes. Stick around.
Teach your children well. Their fathers have. It slowly go by and feed them on your dreams.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Mark Bernier with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Daytona Beach, Florida. Mark, you're a reporter with Talk Radio News?
No, actually, I do a show like you do, but from the right side, Tom. We met a few years ago. It's good to hear your voice again and to be able to join you today. I'm sitting in from Ground Zero in Florida to tell you what's likely to happen.
Ah, okay, great. I appreciate that, Mark. And so from your conservative/Republican point of view, what do you think about the fact that Mitt Romney outspent Newt Gingrich 2-1 in South Carolina and then today came out and said that he was beat in South Carolina because he was outspent? In other words, he lied. And that now he's outspent Newt, what, 6 or 8-1 or more? Down in Florida, and it's only getting him 10 or 12 points.
Yeah, I got to tell you, Tom, I think that after a while, these negative ads against Gingrich, and we had a period, Tom, where there was like four of them that ran in a row on television, that after a while, it's so heavy-handed the way that the Romney campaign has conducted this, it could very well reflect in negative numbers for him. He's still expected to win, but it's probably going to be by about 5 or 6 points. I don't think it's going to be by double digits.
Really?
And a lot of the people I talked to today, were telling me they were so turned off over the weekend that thinking of going to Gingrich or Santorum, even though Santorum is expected to be a distant third, they may just vote for him out of principle because they feel that for him to spend this much time and money on negative ads against Gingrich and not talk about what he'll do for America, what's the deal?
You know? Well, you know, the problem is if you ask Romney what he'll do for America, or if you ask the question, you know, rhetorically or intellectually, what will Romney do for America? And then you look over the last 20 years at his various answers, you can take any issue and come up with either side. You know, that's the problem. He's the original lick your finger and put it to the wind candidate. Now Newt has had his share of flip-flops, but he has been fairly consistent that, you know, he's in the bag with the rich guys. And although I guess that's Mitt's thing these days, too. But Rick Santorum is kind of the I'm not those guys candidate.
Yeah.
But I will
tell you this, that last night, Tom, neither Romney nor Gingrich of the speeches they did attacked each other. They chose to wait until the 11th hour to focus on the issues that they bring to the table why they should be voted for. They did not reflect on each other. That was the first time we'd seen that in about 3 or 4 days. But it may have come too late. Gingrich only had 200 people at his rally. Romney still had huge rallies. Tonight, they're going to watch the results. Gingrich will be in Windermere, which is right outside the city of Orlando. Romney will be in Tampa. And, of course, we know that Santorum is already out of state, and Ron Paul's packed up, and he's left.
Yeah. Is Ron Paul a factor at all in Florida?
He could be, although we just got statistics, Tom, the last 30 minutes to indicate that the voters between 18 and 29 are expected to be light, less than 11%. Those people would probably have gone to Ron Paul.
Those are the Ron Paul voters.
Those people. He will probably take away from Gingrich
now,
more than anything else.
When Florida broke the rules of the Republican Party and did an early primary, they not only lost half their delegates, they also, the rules of the Republican Party say that they have to assign their delegates proportionally. So if Romney gets 55% and Gingrich gets 45%, it won't be that because you got the other two, but you get my point, then the delegates get split that way. But the state of Florida is saying, no, we're not. We're going to be winner take all. And so whoever wins our state is going to get all of our delegates. How does that get reconciled when the national Republican, because after all, this is the Republican Party's election. They own the election. They made the rules. How can Florida say, we're going to ignore your rules?
They're just going to do it. It is winner take all. I guess you have to look at it this way. If you're a Republican candidate, if you're going to lose, better to lose only 50 delegates than lose 100. They're letting the states decide how they're going to run it. And I'm not an expert on this, Tom, but it would appear that the party faithful, the people running the show nationally, are allowing the states to dictate and decide
how they're going
to award their delegates.
They're not. They explicitly said, you know, back when they were establishing dates for primaries that you know, here's a couple states that can have early primaries, Iowa and New Hampshire, and here's other states that can't, and South Carolina, I think. And if any other state wants to, then they're going to have to give up half their delegates, and they're going to become a proportional representation state. And Florida said, we're going to go early, even though you told us not to, and okay, we'll give up half our delegates, but we're going to ignore that proportional representation. And so is there going to be a battle in Tampa where the party of Florida says, okay, here's all our delegates for Mitt, and the national party says, no, half of those are for Gingrich? Or is Gingrich going to enjoin that, or is there going to be a lawsuit or something?
The only way that's going to be is that may be the reason Ron Paul's hanging around, because he thinks he can be a factor at a
convention. Of course it is.
I don't see it, Tom. I just don't feel it from down here that's what's going to happen in the end. But, I mean, who knows? It could end up being exactly the scenario you put out.
Right.
But my intuition is telling me that's not going to happen.
As a conservative or a Republican, Mark Bernier, what kind of help do you think Obama has gotten from all of the, you know, assuming Romney's going to be the candidate? I think that's a safe assumption.
Yeah.
From all of the bashing of Romney that Newt Gingrich is doing, to what extent is that going to help Obama, or will our memory short and that'll be long gone?
Memories are short, but I think it's all will be decided by the economy. If it continues to uptick, and you've talked about it on your show, and we see any kind of a curve up by September, the public here, at least from in Florida, they'll reward the president with reelection. And I think everybody down here knows that. If there's enough of an uptick, memories are short, they'll
right.
say, maybe we should have hung on a little longer and waited to see how the Obama policies played out.
Well, therefore, the Republicans in the House and Senate have to do absolutely everything they can to prevent any money from being spent on things that might stimulate the economy, like rebuilding infrastructure. Because the minute that happens, people will go back to work.
I don't think so. I think they just don't buy this whole thing that you can spend your way into prosperity.
No, I understand. You know, there's a patina of philosophy on it. But the reality is that if they can prevent any federal spending, which will stimulate the economy, you and I both know that, you know, whether or not it's a good stimulus or, you know, something we could debate. But if they can prevent any of that from happening between now and November, they'll have a bigger advantage over Obama than if he can get some spending through. Right.
That spending is going to have to materialize in real good paying jobs, not seasonal employment. We'll
yeah,
see.
No, I wouldn't that be wonderful? And again, I'm not trying to get into a philosophical debate with you, Mark. We'll do that some other time. But anyhow, we're out of time. Mark Bernier, Talk Radio News. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, one of our nation's best investigative reporters when it comes to the issues of election integrity, and on others as well, but in particular this issue, is Brad Friedman. He's the founder and editor of the Brad Blog. Bradblog.com is the website, and a guy for whom I have tremendous respect and admiration. Brad, welcome back to our program.
You're very kind, Tom. Thanks.
Great to
be here.
Great to have you with us, my friend. Virginia, it might be going after. Now, first of all, even before we get into this, there is a difference between election fraud and voter fraud. Would you please give that 30 seconds or so?
Sure. Well, in the case of voter fraud, we're generally talking about voters who commit fraud. In other words, voters who may vote twice or vote in the name of dead people and so forth. Election fraud.
Now, if I may just pause you, and that is about as common as what? And how often does that happen?
Hen's teeth.
Yeah, I mean, if more people die by lightning strikes than commit voter fraud, if my recollection is right, it's on the order of like fewer than a dozen a year. people.
You're right. It's incredibly rare, but it's even rarer at the polling place. And that is, you know, with these Republicans trying to push for this photo, these photo ID restrictions around the country,
right.
Those restrictions would only refer to the polling place itself.
Right. So voter fraud would be more likely to be done by people who are mailing in ballots or doing absentee ballots. Okay. So election fraud. Election fraud is what?
Election fraud is a bit broader. It encompasses voter fraud. Voter fraud is a form of election fraud, but election fraud itself would generally refer to insiders who are gaming the system, whether it's election administrators, other, you know, party officials and so forth, whether they're stuffing the ballot box from the inside or whether they're using a few keystrokes to change the results of an entire election on our now completely computerized election results tabulators around the country.
Okay, so to bring this...
That's a much graver threat.
Absolutely, and that is a much more widespread practice, too, and has been arguably at least since the Civil War and probably since the founding of the Republic. But, you know, with the when African Americans were given the right to vote, the immediate backlash in the South was to figure out ways to disenfranchise black voters, whether it was, you know, poll taxes or literacy tests or simply taking their votes and throwing them away or physically preventing them from voting. So now the state of Virginia, according to your reporting, looks like they may be going after Newt Gingrich or his campaign.
Well, indeed, they are investigating the fraud that, incredibly enough, Newt Gingrich actually admitted to himself. It's on videotape. He says it to it was shown on CNN. He's speaking to a supporter up in Iowa a few weeks back and explaining why he could not get on to the Virginia primary ballot, which requires 10,000 signatures. Mind you, that is Newt's home state of Virginia, and he failed to qualify. He explained the reason for failing to qualify to the supporter. He called it, quote, just a mistake. He said, we needed 11,100, we turned in 11,100 signatures. We only needed 10,000. However, 1,500 of them were fraudulent, turned in, he says, by, quote, just one guy. So one guy working for the Gingrich campaign, according to Newt Gingrich, created 1,500 fraudulent signatures in a failed attempt to get Newt Gingrich on the Virginia primary ballot by Newt Gingrich's own admission. So this was something that I've talked to the Virginia State Board of Elections. They have, in fact, confirmed that if this is true, it would be an illegal act, and that they referred the matter to the state AG's office, Ken Cuccinelli's office. I spoke with them, and they confirmed that, indeed, an investigation into this matter is currently underway in Virginia.
Fascinating. Now, to the larger issue of the state of our elections, just a couple of kind of calibration questions, Brad. You follow this stuff really closely, and it's been a few years since I've had the time to, frankly. How many European nations or other fully developed nations around the world are using electronic voting machines like we do?
Sadly, more and more. I mean, they're really pushing these electronic systems, particularly the 100% unverifiable type of touchscreen voting systems. In some of the largest democracies, like India, Venezuela, and so forth. On the other hand, meanwhile, back in Europe, for example, in Germany, the High Court in Germany looked at it and said, no, those type of voting systems constitute secret vote counting. Our Constitution doesn't allow it. So most of those countries are still voting on paper, and many of them still appropriately, as we should be doing, actually counting their ballots publicly by hand in front of the public so that there will be very few questions about the results.
Right.
That's what we ought to do in this country. In fact, that's what we did, as you recall, back in the Iowa Republican caucuses up there. They counted all of the paper ballots by hand in front of everyone. You had this incredibly close race in the end, and there is almost nobody questioning the results because in the end, they know that all of those ballots were counted publicly, and if there is any funny business with the numbers, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who can step forward to say, no, I was there, I saw the counting, here's my iPhone photograph of the results that night. Counting that way in public at the precinct, it makes it very difficult to game an election.
Yeah.
That's what we ought to be doing, and that's what a lot of the European countries are still doing.
And Canada?
Canada is still doing that. Yep.
They're still
all
voting on paper.
The country.
Okay. So, and finally, who owns the electronic voting machine companies in the United States? And who's tabulating? You know, I've read stories about one state's vote being tabulated in another state. You know, one company's vote. You know, I've heard that the Venezuelans own some of these machines. That
yep.
You know, and which should make Republicans' hair curl. I mean, what's the status of all this stuff that started with way back in the day with Chuck Hagel and whatnot?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, when you say who owns all these machines, I was going to say, well, you got me. I mean, the fact of the matter is these companies have been bought and sold and traded and merged so many times. And you're right, one of the largest companies, Sequoia Voting Systems, was actually owned by a Venezuelan company tied to Hugo Chavez. That company has now been sold off to a Canadian firm by the name of Dominion Voting. Although Dominion and ES&S, the world's largest voting machine company, actually share what had once been the Diebold election system company. You referred to ES&S and Chuck Hagel. In fact, Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, senator from Nebraska, Republican, was in fact the principal owner of ES&S for some time before he ran for the Senate. And miraculously, for the first time in some 20 years, that seat went to a Republican after Nebraska had switched all of their machines over to ES&S.
Right. In fact, the Washington Post called that the upset victory of the year because Chuck Hagel, this white Republican, even won the African-American districts in the big city.
Exactly right. And,
how did that happen? That's amazing.
I dare you to prove that he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's the problem, of course, is there's no way to prove it. So right now we are voting on electronic voting machines that keep no record, and we don't know who owns the machines. And the tabulation is, what about this stuff for the tabulation? I actually asked the former, what's his name from Ohio. I said, weren't your votes counted in Tennessee or something? He said, no. Yeah.
Well, they were and they weren't. The problem is there's both the tabulation system and then there's the reporting system. So they may count them in one place, but then they may send them out of state to be put on the web and reported publicly. And during that period, between the time they're counted and the time they're actually posted, anything can and has happened to those results. And that's exactly what happened in Ohio. Could happen in Florida today, by the way. They're voting on paper ballots, but it is actually illegal in the state of Florida to count a paper ballot by hand, believe it or not.
Amazing. Brad Friedman, bradblog.com. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Illegal to count a paper ballot by hand. You can tell there's been some nasty business going on. That's incredible. We'll be back.
Why can't they count our votes? But they made voting machines.
Talk media for the rest of us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ergode in Berkeley. Hey, I understand you were one of the Occupy Oakland protesters.
Yes, I was, Tom. Thank you for having me on. I was organizing with a bunch of UC Berkeley students at Occupy Cal. I also organized with Occupy Oakland. Sorry, my voice is a little under stress because we've got very poor water in jail, let me tell you. But I was hit by tear gas. I was hit by batons. When we were kettled, we were a peaceful protest in Oakland.
This was the building that you guys were trying to take over?
No. This was later in the evening when we were just protesting and marching in the street.
Uh-huh.
We were kettled on the streets of Oakland in front of a YMCA, about 150 of us in a group. When we were all kettled, I was beat with a baton while I was trying to walk away from the batons. Again, none of us were being violent with the police. Please repeat that. Oakland is being smeared right now. This was a peaceful protest. Right. When we were in a line, I saw the other freelance journalist, Susie Cagle, just a few feet in front of me, also get knocked to the ground for showing her a journalist ID badge.
Yeah, she was on our show yesterday and last night. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I also saw another, just in the front line where I was at facing off in the kettle, there was one other black man who was trying to calm the police down. The police singled him out, threw him to the ground as hard as you could throw another human being to the ground, and beat him for being black. It was the most racist thing I've ever seen. Hmm. We were zip-tied and put on a bus, and those zip ties did not come off for over 10 hours. While we were on the bus, and not allowed on the bus, an old man was with us who was having to just be caught up with it. He was a six-year-old man. He had kidney problems. We were not let into the bathroom. He kept on repeating and asking to go to the bathroom, but they forced him to wet himself, and the police officers and the deputies and the correction officers jeered and laughed at us, laughed at him. And while we were waiting, they collectively punished us for him wetting himself to try to disrupt us, and they made us wait outside longer before we were even brought into jail while they for punishment to that. We were in a cell, in a 10-by-10 cell, with 24 other people just on the concrete. We were never given charges. We were never told what we were being arrested for. No Miranda rights. We were not given any phone call for our duration in the stay. We were in there for 48 hours. I was just released last night. I got to say, after all the ugliness and hatred I saw in all the police, the love was so much stronger, and the solidarity with all of the Oakland commune and my brothers and sisters and my comrades. We kept each other going. It was so strong. The love was so much more powerful than the Oakland police hate. And it was incredible. We would not let there were plenty of vegetarian and vegan people there. They fed us bologna sandwiches. We are forever the bologna block. We made bologna art out of all of this. We wouldn't eat it. We made art. We made messages and posted it on the cells with our other comrades and other cells. Again, the solidarity was so powerful. And a lot of people are going right now, how can I help Occupy? I don't want to be on the streets. I don't want to be arrested like this. And I don't blame you. I don't want to be tear gassed or hit with batons either. How you can help, if you don't want to just come to a meeting or something like that, please bake us some organic cookies.
Okay. Ergo, a question, a genuine question.
Occupycal.net, please donate. Okay, please.
Okay, a genuine question. I read in the San Francisco Chronicle yesterday, and you know, correct me if this reporting is wrong, that the initial march in Oakland that was to the building, the old city, what was it, a city auditorium of some kind that was, say that again louder, the old convention center. That was empty, that you guys were going to occupy, that a lot of the people in the march did not know where they were marching because the leadership of Occupy Oakland didn't want the police to find out where they were going, and so they kept a secret from the police by keeping a secret from the members. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
They had four to five different people of location scouted for backup locations.
Right. So if that's the case, then what has happened to horizontal decision making and everybody having a say and everybody having a completely transparent process? That sounds to me like what you have now is leadership and literally blind followers.
Not blind, but I mean, I agree with
uninformed,
you.
Uninformed, you know.
That wouldn't be my decision, and I agree transparency would work out better in the future. But that was also a consensus process that we voted for some people to make decisions for us. I mean, I don't agree with that, but that's how it happened. We did vote for that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's how it went down.
Okay.
And tactically, I mean, there is some sense to keeping that secret, but then, you know.
Yeah, it's never going to be. I mean, they're going to figure out a way to, you know.
I agree with you.
They got microphones that can hear from, you know, 100 yards away.
Oh, don't I know it? Don't I know it?
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you, transparency and all future things. But, I mean, if you want to think Occupy Oakland has leaders and followers, that is incorrect. We are a genuine direct democracy, and our GAs, our general assemblies, I mean, you can never feel more powerful feeling of being a part of it. Anyone can step up and be involved. This was a tactic made specifically for this action. It had definitely its faults as a tactic, as was witnessed.
Right.
But I know, Tom, I listened to you now for a while on Free Speech TV.
Right.
Appreciate all you
you're doing, I'm saying about, you know, the 1% and calling these plutocrats sociopaths. Please, if you want to support the Occupy movement, please call out these police officers who use tear gas and batons on peaceful protesters.
No, I'm with you. It's absolutely wrong. And
please call them out as sociopaths every day, and you will help us.
Well, I don't
help us by calling them sociopaths.
I don't think that these individuals. I don't know if any of those individual cops are sociopaths or not. I can tell you from personal experience, having gone through the Georgia Police Academy when I was writing novels about private detectives, that a lot of people who go into becoming police do so because they love beating the crap out of people because they have, you know, twisted or damaged personalities. On the other hand, there's a lot of decent people in the police department. But, you know, and my question was not to be confrontational. It was genuine curiosity. When I read that in the San Francisco Chronicle, I was stunned. And it's good to hear your answer, particularly that, you know, you guys are rethinking and recalibrating that. Ergo, thanks a lot for the feedback. You're absolutely right. We need to stand in solidarity with the Occupy movement all across the country.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Okay, now next, the good, the bad, and the new vocabulary word, ugly. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very melanochromously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. The good, Credit Municipal de Paris, the 375-year-old French bank, has made the decision to cancel the debts of many of its poorest customers. The bank announced that it would cancel the debts of individuals who owe the equivalent of $190 or less on low-interest loans for inexpensive valuables. Like most of Europe, the French economy is struggling, and the bank's decision to forgive the small loans has quickly helped improve the economic well-being of thousands of customers who now have more cash to spend and stimulate the economy. Imagine that. A bank actually forgiving the loans of its customers just to be nice. And they didn't even make the customers take a vow of silence. Take that, Bank of America. The bad. Rick, don't Google my name, Santorum. One of Santorum's go-to policy proposals over the GOP primary season, and his entire career for that matter, has been to limit the payments victims of medical malpractice can seek through lawsuits. It's called tort reform. Santorum argues medical malpractice lawsuits help to drive up the cost of health care. Even the CBO report found that tort reform, as in limiting medical malpractice suits, would only result in 0.1% of savings on total health care spending. But even worse, Rick Santorum is a hypocrite. In 1999, his wife filed a malpractice lawsuit for $500,000, claiming that a chiropractor had left her with permanent back injuries that would result in a lifetime of pain. This lawsuit came just 5 years after Santorum had proposed legislation to limit the rewards of malpractice lawsuits. So while large rewards are just fine for Mrs. Santorum, they're the root of all health care cost woes for the rest of America. Yet another example of the hypocrisy that conservatives practice so well. And the very, very ugly, The Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal recently published an op-ed piece written by 16 prominent global warming deniers with various and minimal scientific backgrounds, including the likes of oil company executives. In that piece, the 16 argued that while man-made carbon dioxide has some effects on warming the planet, the effects are small and there's nothing to panic about. 16 deniers argued that all the other scientists who believe in global warming are just trying to scare the general public. These other scientists included a group of 255 members of the United States National Academy of Sciences, who wrote a much more scientific and reality-based op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal. However, Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal declined to publish the piece. This blatant form of bias on the part of the Wall Street Journal should not come as a surprise to anyone. After all, it is part of Rupert Murdoch's empire and a close cousin of GOP TV, a.k.a. Fox News. The United States is the only developed nation in the world where global warming is still up for debate. And you can thank hack journalists like those at the Wall Street Journal for it. It's just very, very ugly. I don't know how else to say it. It really is. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
But if this goes back to your interview with Mr. Beto of the Reason Institute.com.
Sure. Yeah.
And what spurred me to call, I used to work for the New York State Department of Agriculture,
mm-hmm.
and their only interest was protecting the consumer. And there were three sections, the meat, the dairy, and the produce of it.
Right.
But when I was working in the dairy section, there was a case came in where people were reporting sickness in this certain area. So they sent some inspectors out, and they went to a supermarket, at you know, like everybody else can do, buy this product. It was ice cream. And they detected the ice cream and said it was contaminated. And they sent an inspection team out to this person's place of business. And it happened to be a small farm. What he did was he was storing his containers, open containers, in the attic of this barn with an open window.
Yikes.
So I was thinking your pigeons from Xenu
right.
flew in there, and they would drop. They would do their droppings over these open containers.
Yeah.
And then he'd use those containers and sell them. And it was a sporadic sort of sense, but it was an unusual sort of illness that they were complaining about.
Yeah.
And when they finally closed them down, and in the process, this guy became so ugly that even his wife left him.
Wow.
Now, that's the type of thing that the New York State Department of Agriculture was doing. They were like, you know, the whole idea of fresh meats in the suburbs, and then as they got older, they moved them into the inner city markets. That became apparent. So they'd load them with sodium sulfite
right.
and other of these things to keep
right.
them red.
Keep them red, yeah.
Looking red. And people would get sick. Now, they're still doing that. I imagine they... You know,
yeah, and they also use a gas. I think it might be carbon dioxide, but they also use a gas to do that, or nitrogen or something. I don't know. But,
yeah, they used to use sodium benzoate and sodium sulfite.
Yeah.
But the whole thing of, you know, of leaving these people unprotected or without recourse.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, this is what the libertarians want to do, and the so-called conservative Republicans. And their theory is that if somebody sells contaminated meat and people die from it, that people will realize, hey, that guy is selling contaminated meat, and people will stop buying it. And that's a theory that works fine in a town of 300 people, right?
Yeah.
Where everybody knows everybody. I mean, we used to live in Montpelier, Vermont.
What about the person who died?
Well, that's the other problem. I mean, there's two problems with this theory. The first is that without having a precautionary principle, you've got to wait until a harm has happened before anybody does anything about it. And the second is that, you know, like we used to live in Montpelier, Vermont, a little town of 7,000 people, the smallest state capital in the nation. And there was an eye doctor in town who was like getting old and probably drug addicted. And he was mangling people's eyes. And the word got around and he basically got run out of town. Nobody would go to him anymore. Now, that's fine in a little town, but where did that guy go? I have no idea. But what if he went to New York City? There's an unending stream of suckers, as it were, of people who have no way of knowing. Because, I mean, you got millions and millions of people, and that's why we have to have these kind of agencies. Excellent point, Frank.
Well,
thanks.
One of the things you bring up about Beto, which is amazing, you know, already brought it up about the if only. But the other part of it is, if they can't describe something in complete logical, simplistic logical statements, they won't go for it. They, you know,
right.
Like the whole...
It has to be a bumper sticker.
Yeah, it has to be a bumper
yeah.
sticker.
Complexity is not something that they do well, and complexity tragically doesn't work well in politics. Excellent point, Frank. I want to move along. We've got a whole bunch of calls here. I'd like to get Joe in Maui, Hawaii. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to talk about the fact that the education chair in the legislature here, who's a Democrat, Roy Takumi, introduced a bill to end tenure in Hawaii, and they're going to hear the bill Wednesday. And you had brought it up, and I tried looking through your transcripts, the story of how tenure started. And I've been contacting him, and he thinks it's just he was put in place to save bad teachers, which is
you're talking about tenure in higher education or tenure in primary education?
Elementary.
In elementary education. Okay.
Yeah.
You know,
it's really sad because tenure is a due process. to ensure that teachers get fired for not doing their job instead of getting fired for a personal vendetta. I mean, I personally had a problem where with a principal where I went to the paper because a roof was like falling apart and the current governor wasn't releasing funds, and I knew if I embarrassed her with the fact that kids were going to a school that had the roof falling in on them, that she would do something, and she did, but then that created a rift between me and the principal, and he tried doing everything to kick me out. And without tenure, you know, then I get fired instead of firing me for, you know, poor job performance.
Right, you're a teacher. So, the original theory of tenure for higher education was that that somebody who has passed through all the portals that you have to pass through in order to get to the point of tenure, and they are not insignificant. Mostly they have to do with longevity, but nonetheless, there's lots and lots of opportunities to weed out bad people through the course of longevity. That when somebody has passed through all those portals, they, particularly in education, in higher education, if you have the philosophy of we want diversity of opinion, then people who may have unpopular opinions, but they're very, very good teachers, and they know their topic well, that they will be protected. They will be protected from the whims of popular politics, as it were, by virtue of that tenure.
It's so sad because I think George Bush's No Child Left Behind is just working so well at demonizing and making look.
Oh, it's devastating our schools.
And look so and looking so bad.
Right. So you're a teacher, Joe.
What'd you say?
You're a teacher.
Yes, I'm a teacher. Yeah, that's calling you on a break right now with an alias. This is just ridiculous because, you know, when it comes to Democratic and Republican philosophies, Democrats should be working and be knowledgeable of, you know, strong public education philosophies.
Right.
And it's just so sad when people like the education chair in Hawaii, Roy Takumi, has no idea what they are.
I'm with you. So the upshot, I'm assuming the call to action then of your phone call is if you are watching or listening in Hawaii, call the Commissioner of Education and register your concerns about teachers losing tenure.
Yeah, there's testimony that can be put in today. It's the bill is being heard by the Education Committee tomorrow, Wednesday. So phone calls would be wonderful from any other advocates that you know, in favor of a solid public education.
Right. Okay. And actually, anybody in the United States could call. I mean, you know, Hawaii is part of the United States, right? It's way out there, but it's
a lot for everything you're doing.
Thanks a lot, Joe. It's great to hear from you, and I miss Maui. Louise and I have had several wonderful vacations there. Or workcations, like, you know, attending conferences and things, but it was always great fun. We'll be back. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And what's Senator Sheldon Whitehouse up to? I'll tell you about that right after this. Jacob says Leonard Cohen's got a brand new album out, brand new songs, new poems. He's one of the best poets out there. Louise is on her way. She's looking. Jimmy in Hanover, Indiana. Hey, Jimmy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. All kinds of stuff. But the main
Pick
thing
one, please.
Is, okay. The main thing is I tried to lump everything into one thing, all the issues. And it's about the 99% of the United States. It's we the people of the United States are the only ones that can save our country and our planet. We got to stop the liars, thieves, and killers that make up our corporate, militarized, banker-run AIPAC government.
Okay, all right.
Take it back.
Okay, Jimmy. I would pull out the gratuitous AIPAC reference. Not that I like them, but you know, it could be misconstrued as an anti-Semitic remark. But the rest of it. Anyhow, Joe in Portland. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Oh, Tom, thank you very much for everything you do. You answered a question for me earlier this morning when you were talking to a caller, and he's talking about George Soros. I constantly get the come back from people I'm talking with that Democrats do it too, or Democrats are just as bad. And I've often wondered if the contributions they get from billionaires and from unions come anywhere near equaling what the Koch brothers.
They
and,
don't. They don't. They're a small fraction, and the math has been done, and it's all fairly obvious. And a group that has done great work, great research in this area, and you can find it, you can search it on their website, is the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org.
I suspected that was the case, and I'm glad to know that. And I have an idea where we could force a wedge in the Republican Party, just as they're always trying to conquer and divide and conquer us. What about a piece of legislation could be sponsored by Bernie Sanders and a Tea Party member, I believe, of Congress. What about a piece of legislation that taxed campaign contributions 50% when they're over $100, and that 50% of the revenue going to pay down the national deficit?
Yeah, or it could go into a fund to help finance campaigns, you know, like that $5 or whatever.
Well,
you can
I
check
thought
off
of that
on
first of all, but it would be much simpler just to pay down the national deficit, because everybody's in favor of that, and the Tea Party people have made that a prime objective.
Yeah.
And well, on our side, that would be all right, I assume, but we would be cutting the plutocracy's contributions in half.
Yeah. No, it's an idea, Joe. The question is whether the Supreme Court would declare it unconstitutional, but it's a very good idea. Thanks for sharing it. Thanks for the call. Roy in Sunrise Beach, Missouri. Hey, Roy, what's up?
Oh, I was just wondering why they have the right to just go out and put any size that they want to on a package. In other words, we have no control over the size of a package anymore. To make it legal, all they got to do is write down what was a 16-ounce package, change it to a 15 1/4-ounce package. Or
right.
Whatever.
And this shrinkage that we've seen in our food products in particular over the last couple of decades has been pretty pervasive. You know, a lot of things, you know, it used to be 20 ounces, now it's 16 or 18, but the price remains the same. Rather than raising prices, they've been shrinking the size of packages. And you're right, right? There's no recourse for it as long as it's disclosed. And the problem that it illustrates, and thanks for calling and pointing this out, the problem that it illustrates isn't so much that they're doing it and getting away with it, but that the why or the how is it that they can do this and get away with it? And it's because there's no competition. It's because the agricultural industry, the food industry, the product processed foods industry is basically a handful of large corporations, giant corporations that operate under hundreds of brand names. And because there's no competition, they can do whatever they damn well please. And frankly, that's not the American way. Vic in Pittsburgh, Missouri. Hey, Vic, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Earlier you had a discussion with a guy talking about the government controlling our health. Well, I'm to say right now, based upon the things in our lives, we've been controlled all the time. We were told, well, we had to put catalytic converters on our cars, you know, to eliminate, they should put catalytic converters on the smokestacks.
Yeah.
We've been the ones doing all the things. They should be paying the tax. They should be paying a health tax to us for all the spillages, for all the poisons that they put in and the stuff that they did in our bodies.
Yeah, there's an estimated million cases of asthma a year and tens of thousands of cancers a year simply as a consequence of burning oil products in the United States and coal products in the United States. And those industries do not pay a penny of all those costs associated with those health consequences. That's called internalizing profits and externalizing losses. And those externalities, that, you know, the cost of people getting cancer from the refinery down the road is one of the areas where big corporations make a profit. And other countries are capturing that money. In Denmark, for example, they put an extra dollar, in fact, it might have been even $2, on the cost of a gallon of gasoline simply to pay for the contributions to their health care system, because they know that burning gasoline is causing cancers.
Why don't we do that? Taking like a surcharge kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely with you that we need to capture it. And thanks for the call. We need to capture those externalities and have these companies pay for it. Vic in, oh, whoops, that was Vic. Larry in Canton, Michigan. Hey, Larry, a little less than a minute to wrap up the show here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hartman. Thanks for taking my call. I'm interested in your opinion on something.
because of all the inequality in this country, not just financial, but cultural and racial. I wonder, what do you think this country and world would be like if John Fitzgerald Kennedy had been able to do his two terms?
Had lived. You know, that's a question I've wondered many times. I've written or co-authored with Lamar Waldron two books about the Kennedy assassination. And I think, you know, between John and Robert and Martin Luther King being murdered, all three of them, that had none of that happened, that this would be a much better world. And, you know, we lost a good man. Larry, thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, libertarians, real conservatives, or do they have more in common with progressives? What? And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.